Okay, this is the fourth session of Hilchos Tshuva of the Rambam. Okay. Now, today, I want to go back to the beginning of Hilchos Tshuva, beginning of chapter 1, which we skipped. We started with chapter 2. But we've now arrived at Halacha 8 in chapter 2, and that's very relevant to what happens at the beginning. Today, you have to put your thinking caps on, some logic to go through. If you're interested in philosophy of law, it should be interesting. Maimonides, in every section, at first, tells you what the mitzvos, the commandments are that we discussed in that section, and then he goes through the laws. In the laws of tshuva, he says, mitzvah saseh achas is one positive commandment, vuhu, and that is, that the transgressor shall return from his transgression before Hashem and confess. There's one positive commandment, and that is that the transgressor shall return from his transgression before Hashem and confess. That seems plain enough. What must he do? He's got to return and confess. Now listen to how he explains the process in the first law. All the mitzvahs of the Torah, positive or negative, if a person violated one of them, purposely or negligently, we'll come back to that, when he does tshuva and returns from his sin, then he's obligated to confess. That doesn't sound like the same thing at all. When he returns, when he does tshuva, when that happens, then he's obligated to confess. What is he leaving out? What's he leaving out? No. Listen again. When I start off like this, I'm narrowing the scope down to what I've said now, just now. Let's start again. There's a headline. There's one positive commandment. What is the commandment? That the transgressor return from his sin and confess. That's the commandment. Not quite right. Let's try it again. The commandment is he should return from his sin and confess. Now Maimonides says, when he explains the law, he says, when the person will return from his sin, then he's obligated to confess. What is he leaving out? Okay, you're right. Now, say it. What is he leaving out?
Well, I have a different... I don't know what he's leaving out.
Oh, let's start with that. He's leaving out the obligation to return. He's leaving out the obligation to return. In the headline, he says there's one positive commandment. The commandment is return and confess. So, that's a commandment. We're talking about a positive commandment. God says, do this. What does he say, do? Return and confess. So when he starts the law, I would expect him to say, when a person performs a transgression, he's obligated to return and confess. He doesn't say that. What he says is, when he will return, then he's obligated to confess. It sounds like returning is free. You know, it's up to you. Do it or you don't. You just have to know that if you're going to return, you better confess. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Confession is an integral part of returning, and without it, you haven't satisfied the returning. That's not what he says in the headline. Not what he says when he describes that initial commandment. That's a seeming contradiction in the space of five lines. To a man who, among other things, was a master logician. Now you can imagine the commentators have been exercised over this. Okay, the problem is clear. Now the Minchas Chinuch, a great commentator and thinker from about 200 years ago, who happened to be a Belzer Chosid, in case you have lingering... prejudices about Hasidim, offered the following solution. He said that there are, you could divide commandments, you could divide them in many ways, but for this purpose, you could divide them into two kinds. There are obligatory commandments, and then there are procedural commandments. Procedural. There are commandments that say, if you do a certain thing in a certain way, then you get certain results. I'm not telling you to do it. It's up to you. You want to do it? Fine. You don't want to do it? Skip it. It's of no interest. Just telling you that if you do it this way, you get certain results. If you do it a different way, you get a different result. For example, slaughtering an animal. There's a certain way of slaughtering an animal that makes it kosher. You kill the animal some other way, it's not kosher. From the point of view of that commandment, if you want to be a vegetarian, it's perfectly all right. Who cares? The commandment's not telling you to run around and slaughter animals. It's just telling you, if you slaughter it this way, it's kosher. If you slaughter it that way, it's not kosher. One of the 613 commandments is divorce. Surely, the Torah is not telling us everybody should divorce his wife. What the Torah is telling us is, if you're married, and for whatever reason, the marriage has to be dissolved, this is the way it's dissolved. It's a procedure for dissolving a marriage. If you do it this way, it's dissolved. If you don't do it this way, it's not dissolved. Says the Minchas Chinuch, one could explain the Rambam here in the following way. When he says the name of the mitzvah, it's true. The mitzvah is the mitzvah of tshuva, of return. That doesn't mean you have to do it. Elsewhere he'll tell you that the mitzvah is a mitzvah of gerushin, of divorce. It doesn't mean you have to do it. The word mitzvah includes procedures with their consequences. The word mitzvah doesn't mean commandment that I have to do it. So in the headline where he says there's one positive commandment, don't mistake the word commandment there for something you have to do. It's just the subject of these laws, which could be procedural. And in the first paragraph, he's telling you, indeed, it is procedural. So the picture here is this. A person performs a transgression. There's a way out. There's a way to free himself from all liability. There's a procedure that can cut himself off from his past. It's a free procedure. He can do it if he wants. And if he omits it, he has no additional transgression, no additional failure. He just remains with the old failures. Therefore, the Rambam says, when he will do tshuva, then you have to know, however, that tshuva has certain necessary components, one of which is confession, and therefore he says he's obligated to confess. That's the Minchas Chinuch suggestion as to how to understand the Rambam. Do you understand what I said so far? Any problems with what I said so far? Okay, other commentators take it in a different way, with a much more subtle analysis, based on the fact that in chapter 2, law 7, the Rambam says the following words. Now, given what I've told you, listen carefully. We wouldn't have to ring the alarm bells. Yom Kippur is the time of tshuva for all, individual and group. And it is the end of pardon, forgiveness for the Jewish people. Therefore, everyone is obligated to do tshuva and to confess on Yom Kippur. Oh ho! Here is the missing clause. Here he does say everyone is obligated to do tshuva and to confess. The clause we wished we had in chapter 1, paragraph 1, over here in chapter 2, paragraph 7, he writes it explicitly. So it isn't as if there's no obligation to do tshuva. Somehow, however, he stuck it over here in discussing Yom Kippur. Now, the first thought of someone who's trained in Jewish law would be to say, maybe what he's saying is, and in fact there are those who hold this way, maybe what he's saying is that tshuva is not an independent obligation. It's part of the obligations of Yom Kippur. It's built into the things that you have to do in Yom Kippur. So just like you have to fast on Yom Kippur, but only Yom Kippur, to fast any other day, biblically, and various certain sacrifices in the temple that are on Yom Kippur they don't have on other days. So another element of the day is doing tshuva. But that's not correct. Turns out that that's not correct. Why? Because those who associate the mitzvah of tshuva with Yom Kippur have a verse for that. And the verse is, Lifnei Hashem Titaru, purify yourselves before God. And the before God there refers to Yom Kippur, and it's telling you, because you're standing before God in Yom Kippur, you should purify yourselves. The Rambam doesn't mention that verse. He doesn't mention that verse. And those who remember, as we went through the chapter 2 in the beginning, for every detail he has a verse. For every detail he has a verse. And here, he doesn't say anything about a verse concerning Yom Kippur. What he says is, I'll read it again to you, Yom Kippur is the time of tshuva for all, individual and the group, and it is the end of pardon and forgiveness for the Jewish people. Therefore, he says, therefore, everyone's obligated to do tshuva and confess. The source of the obligation comes from the fact that it is the end of pardon and forgiveness. So to build it into Yom Kippur per se, without using the verse of Yom Kippur, would be a very peculiar thing to say. Furthermore, it's more mysterious. What could he possibly mean by saying it's the end of pardon and forgiveness? Suppose a person commits an Avera January 2007. Can't he repent for it in 2010? Of course he can. He can do tshuva for the whole, at any time during his life. There's no cutoff point. You can't say, well, you went through on Yom Kippur, you didn't do tshuva, bang, you've lost. Nothing you can do about it. Not true. It's not true. Well, but suppose he doesn't forget. He's saying it's the end of pardon and forgiveness. That's not a psychological remark, that's a legal remark. Now, so some of the commentators explain as follows. I'm going to give you an analogy, and then I'll apply the analogy. The analogy starts with a question. On this question, you have to think hard. There's a mitzvah to put on tefillin every day, except for Shabbos and holidays. Put on tefillin every day. When do you have to put them on? Right. Biblically, any time during the day. From sunrise to sunset, somewhere in there should be 5 minutes. Gets to be noon. And there's Reuven, you know, lazing in his lounge chair. And says, Reuven, what about tefillin? He says, I got time. It's only noon. You know, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock. I got time. Last 5 minutes of the day. He says, Reuven, listen, time's up. He says, I'm not doing it. Then the sun sets, no tefillin. Now, think very carefully. When is this transgression of not putting on tefillin? When?
Whenever he had the time to, and he didn't do it.
Good. Now answer it directly. You just gave a criterion. You didn't give the answer, but I think you got the right criterion. When is this transgression?
At any moment he wasn't.
In other words, all day. All day. The transgression is all day. It's not in the last 5 minutes. The definition of the transgression is a tefillin-less day. Right? Could have put it on at 9 in the morning, or at noon, 3 in the afternoon, 6 in the evening. Could have put it on at any of those times. The transgression is a day without tefillin. Okay? True, if he hasn't put it on till the last 5 minutes, then indeed, he really has an absolute obligation to put on the last 5 minutes, but that doesn't mean that the time of the transgression is in the last 5 minutes. The time of the transgression is the whole day, yeah.
So if you put on tefillin, push it off a little, you put on tefillin at 3 o'clock, does that mean that you transgress the whole day that passes you?
No, because...
You just transgressed the period of time.
You haven't transgressed anything. The definition of the transgression is a tefillin-less day. That's the definition of transgression. Is your day tefillin less? No, at 3 o'clock you put them on.
Okay, so if you put on tefillin at some point during the day, then you haven't transgressed, but if you haven't put them on all day, then you're transgressing the whole day.
Because the definition of the transgression is a day without tefillin. And this was a day without a tefillin. Okay? Okay, now. Okay, but yes, but I'm just working with time and beginning and middle and end and where how to locate things. I'm just giving you a model. Now let's ask. Reuven does a transgression in January. So now there's the mitzvah of tshuva. When is it? How long does it go? Is there a span of time to which it's attached? Obviously, as soon as he does the transgression, he could do tshuva, and be appropriate to do tshuva. But
the mitzvah starts the moment he is done with the transgression, and it goes until he dies.
Well, not quite. Not quite. You're now confusing the mitzvah with the possibility. What do you want to say?
He does tshuva up until the time of Yom Kippur, until he's forgiven, which is why Yom Kippur is specified for forgiveness.
So, in other words, like this. The mitzvah of tshuva is from the time of the transgression until the end of Yom Kippur. If a person performs a transgression in January and he goes through the end of Yom Kippur without doing tshuva, then he has violated the mitzvah of tshuva. He's violated it. If he performs a transgression in January and doesn't do tshuva until June, he's delayed it. That's perhaps not the most elevated attitude, the most, you know, perfectly responsible expression. But he hasn't violated the mitzvah of tshuva. Like a person who puts on tefillin at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Tefillin is a precious mitzvah, and it's good to do it. It's early enough the day as possible. You should do it with you in the daven shacharis. Oh, that's fine and good. But he put it on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He did it, and there's no violation. He hasn't violated the mitzvah of tefillin. A person does a transgression in January, and he does tshuva in June. He's not violated anything. He's fulfilled his obligation to tshuva because tshuva, like tefillin, has a time period associated with it. The positive commandment of tshuva has a time period associated with it. What's the time period? From the transgression till the end of Yom Kippur. If he lets Yom Kippur go by without doing tshuva, what's his situation then?
Can he still do it next year?
He certainly can, but... What did he transgress?
Not being tshuva.
Correct. He has an extra liability now. He has an extra liability. In January, he ate the cheeseburger. And then he thought, oh, that was terrible. I shouldn't have done that. And he thinks about doing tshuva. And he thinks and thinks and thinks. And he puts it off and puts it off and puts it off. And Yom Kippur goes by. Now he has two liabilities. He ate the cheeseburger and he didn't do tshuva in the specified time period. Okay, you can always do tshuva till you die. But now he's got a double tshuva to do. He has to do tshuva for the cheeseburger and tshuva for not doing tshuva. Right? So, the Rambam in chapter 1, paragraph 1, is describing the mechanics of tshuva, but since he hasn't introduced Yom Kippur yet, he can't describe the obligation of tshuva. The obligation, the chiyuv of doing tshuva is do tshuva before the end of Yom Kippur. That's why he says... That on Yom Kippur, that's a time of tshuva for everyone, for individual and the group, and everyone is obligated to do tshuva on Yom Kippur, not because it's a mitzvah in Yom Kippur, but because the whole time period ends on Yom Kippur. If you haven't done it up until then you have to do it on Yom Kippur. If Yom Kippur goes by, it's like the last 5 minutes of the day with tefillin, if it goes by, then you've violated the commandment to do tshuva. Tshuva is an obligation, and it's this obligation that covers the time span until the end of Yom Kippur. Okay, you with me? Now this picture solves a very interesting problem. The Gemara says, and the Rambam brings it, that during, suppose a person on Rosh Hashanah is 50-50. We would have to discuss how it could be possible, how probable it is, and all that, but suppose, just hypothetically, a person on Rosh Hashanah is 50-50, half good and half bad, so his condition for the coming year can't be decided. It's decided on terms of the majority. And this is the rule that's given. If, before Yom Kippur, he does tshuva, then he'll be judged for good. And if, before the end of Yom Kippur, he does not do tshuva, then he'll be sealed for bad. So let's think. Why is it only dependent upon tshuva? 10 days. There are lots and lots of mitzvahs you can do in those 10 days. do charity and help widows and orphans, and you can daven and you can learn Torah and you can do all sorts of things. Why is tshuva the only element here that counts in changing the judgment? That's fairly easy to answer. Why is tshuva the only thing that counts? Because the judgment is on...
not doing tshuva.
What's the judgment on?
Majority.
Majority of what? Which averas and mitzvahs? Say it. Last year. The judgment is on last year's performance. On last year's performance. You need something now, during the 10 days, that can reach back into last year and change the accounting. How can you do that? Giving charity now isn't going to do that. Praying isn't going to do that. Visiting people in the hospital isn't going to do that. That's all on the next year's calculation. Ah, but tshuva has this great, great property that it can change the past. We spoke about this twice already, right? That's the inherent paradox in tshuva, that it wipes out the past. So, the person is 50-50, and he does tshuva even for one transgression of last year. That one transgression is removed from the negative side, and now the positive side is more than 50%, right? That's easy. What's not so easy is the other side. If he doesn't do tshuva, then the judgment goes badly. Why should that be? If he doesn't do tshuva? I mean, tshuva is going to be done. It's Yom Kippur, and it's part of Yom Kippur, and all the rest. How can that retroactively change the balance for last year?
Because these 10 days are specifically set aside for doing tshuva between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
That may be so, but you might just as well say they're set aside for charity. So what? How does that change last year's balance?
Because he failed to do the mitzvah of tshuva.
And therefore?
So sinned on not doing. He has basically committed an avera by not fulfilling the mitzvah of tshuva. Therefore, it's not 51-50.
But one could say to you that the day of doing tshuva is Yom Kippur. And he failed to do it in Yom Kippur means he's now guilty of a transgression in Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the New Year's calculation, not the old year's calculation. But now we answered this. That was the first. And therefore what?
And therefore by Yom Kippur you should already have done the tshuva.
Good, so if he doesn't by Yom Kippur, then isn't the Yom Kippur problem? Yeah. How does it get to be less? That's a person with a black yarmulke. Now then. Let's think, what did we say about the tefillin? We said, if he lets the whole day go by without tefillin, when is the transgression? All day! It's all day! It's a tefillinless day. The transgression attaches to the whole time period. So here too, if the time period is from the transgression in January till the end of Yom Kippur, and till the end of Yom Kippur he doesn't do tshuva, then it is January to Yom Kippur without tshuva. And that then confirms another transgression for the prior time period, last year, and that's how we can weigh it down on the negative side. This analysis is really a beautiful analysis. It's a beautiful analysis. The one who raised, I can't remember which of the commentators raised it, he made the following additional analogy to associate it with the Rambam. You know that every Jewish male should be circumcised. Usually, it's the father who has the responsibility for his child. Suppose it doesn't get done. Then when the child is an adult, he has responsibility for his own circumcision. A Jewish male who doesn't have circumcision is subject to kores. Kores means being divinely cut off. Now, does that mean every minute, suppose he finally gets around to doing the circumcision when he's 22. Does that mean he's suffered the penalty of kores for 9 years since he was 13? Or if it starts at 20, then for 2 years, from 20 to 22? Rambam says no. Kores applies, he says, if he dies without circumcision. He dies without circumcision. If he does it, 5 minutes before he dies, the penalty of kores doesn't apply. So, say the commentators, what is the Rambam telling us? The Rambam telling us is that the crime of being uncircumcised is having an uncircumcised life. That's the crime. And therefore, if in his last year he becomes circumcised, he didn't have an uncircumcised life. It's just like tefillin. It's just like tefillin. Whenever he does the circumcision, he satisfied it. Again, it's not elevated. It's not appropriate for the majesty of the mitzvah, what it does for you and all the rest, but he satisfied it. Koresh doesn't apply. The Rav doesn't agree, but that's what the Rambam says. So tefillin has this character, and Koresh, and circumcision has this character, and this commentators want to say that for the Rambam, tshuva has this character. I mean, Gifter is one of the people in this here who already tshuva says. So it has this character as well, and therefore you're definitely obligated to do it, but the obligation stretches until the end of Yom Kippur. And if the end of Yom Kippur goes by, when he says that it's the end of pardon and forgiveness, what he means is a period of time was set aside for pardon and forgiveness through tshuva. And that period of time ends in Yom Kippur. Of course, there's more time later. You can do it again. But the obligation of tshuva is tagged to the time in which this should be repaired. And it should be repaired before Yom Kippur. Yeah.
So, say a person doesn't do tshuva and Yom Kippur is over and they've been judged. So, the tshuva can change the past. So, say sometime during that year they repent for not repenting. And so then, can they change the outcome of their year?
That's a tricky idea. I will just mention briefly what the truth is about this matter. You're asking, there was an evaluation of his actions and a judgment and a decree as to what will happen to him in the coming year. Now, if he does tshuva later and changes his, and thereby changes his record for the previous year, can he change the decree that was established, at least by the end of Yom Kippur, for the coming year? I'll tell you something which is very important and very broad application, very broad consequences. I can't take you through all the examples now, but every rule, every statement, every proclamation that you find in the Chazal has exceptions. At least everyone that I've ever found has exceptions. Sometimes the Talmud mentions the exceptions explicitly. Sometimes the commentators mention exceptions. Tosfos in several places says, Ein lamedim in a klolos. When the Mishnah will say, all A's are B's, Tosfos will say on the spot, no, not all A's are B's. When it says all A's are B's, it doesn't mean it to be a universal statement. It doesn't mean that. That's not the way Chazal intended their words. Indeed, Tosfos says, even if you have a statement like this, all A's are B's except X, Y, Z, and you say, look, they listed the exceptions. So surely this one is exact. So Tosfos, even that's not exact. There could be other exceptions as well. The reason they listed XYZ is because in this context, XYZ are the subject that we're talking about. So you have to know that in this context, but in other contexts, there could be other exceptions. Now, the same thing is true with a decree about what will happen in the coming year. It's not absolute. The Ramban in the Shar HaGemul gives an explicit example of his own of how a person could have a decree assigned to him, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and through an action later in the year, change it. His has tricky, interesting properties of its own. I don't know if I'll do that for you now, but he says explicitly that a later action can change it. If you ask me, if so, then what's the purpose of the decree? Since the later action can change it, the answer is the decree sets up inertia, which makes it much more difficult to change. Doing tshuva from Shani Yom Kippur, we saw, is miskapelas miyad, it's immediately accepted, person forgiven immediately. So then the decree hasn't happened yet. Once the decree has happened, so it's much more difficult to change. It's a little bit like, Mahavdil, it's a little bit like in American law, a person is judged and gets a sentence and he goes to jail. The president can pardon him. But boy, is that difficult to arrange. Right? So is the sentence of the judge and the jury absolute? No, there's a way out. But once you're judged and you know the jury has settled it, so then it's very, very difficult to change, but it can be changed. So the decree sets up a barrier, an inertia that's very difficult to overcome, but it can be overcome. And there are no rules. I've not found any rules that are absolute in this respect. There's even one where there's a verse that God says, test me in this. And the Gemara says, you test God, he'll pay you and it'll work. The Rabbeinu Yonah in Shaarei Teshuva says, no, doesn't have to happen. I mean, it's you have to know how to read what they say. When they say all A's are B's, what they mean is, usually A's are B's, normally A's are B's, most of the time A's are B's, but not, as we might mean, every last A is a B. No, that's not what they mean. And therefore, when you find exceptions, that to them would be natural, of course. No, not all cases are that way. Question? There's a question up? Yeah.
So just to elaborate on that, you can then change it in the following year, but it's harder. What does that mean? You have to take on extra mitzvahs or something?
No, a normal procedure like that won't help. Taking on extra mitzvahs will add to your merit for this year. It's not going to change the decree from before. It would have to be something very heroic and very very extraordinary that would appeal to another facet in the rules, which could then be used to trump this facet in the rules. That's the way the Ramban constructs his example. Okay? Now, let me comment on a few other words that Rambam said over here in the beginning. Also very important. The Rambam started off, every mitzvah in the Torah, positive or negative, if a person violated one of them, whether deliberately or negligently, zadon means he knew what he was doing and he had the ability to resist and he chose freely to do the wrong thing. Okay, chose freely. Some choices are harder, some choices are easier. There's degradations of responsibility. But he had the ability to choose the right thing and he chose the wrong thing. Shkoga usually means he did it in ignorance, but he was responsible not to be ignorant. He should not have been ignorant. And he, one might say, deliberately engineered his own ignorance. He didn't know it was wrong. But he knew very well that he should have looked it up or should have been better informed, and he ignored it. Now, that's what he says here positively. In his commentary in the Mishnah, the Rambam goes on to spell out the consequence that ba'ones, he's not responsible and doesn't have to do tshuva. Ones means it's beyond his control or beyond his responsibility to control. There are times when we are permitted to view the world on the basis of evidence and take action on the basis of that evidence. And if it turns out that the evidence was wrong and the reality was different, we are not responsible for the outcome. There's something called a chazakah. A chazakah is a legal presumption. As one of my friends said, the chazakah is what you do until the doctor comes. For example, a standard chazakah is, if a thing was in a condition, you're allowed to assume it remained in that condition until you have explicit information to the contrary. So, I use this rule. Here's a good example. Your tefillin. So, some say, although it's even this is controversial nowadays, you should check them twice every 7 years. If you check the tefillin and find a fault, what's the probability that the fault occurred 2 minutes before you checked the tefillin? Probability is 0.00001%. Obviously, if you find that a letter's cracked or something like that, it probably happened a month ago, or 3 months ago, or 7 months ago. What about your mitzvah tefillin all that time? You weren't wearing kosher tefillin all that time. You don't lose anything for that. You don't lose anything for that because you were perfectly responsible in checking the tefillin. Now, notice here, you could have checked them every day. You could have, but you weren't responsible to check them every day. That's already called onus. It's beyond your ability, beyond your responsibility. That's not called shogeg. Shogeg is negligence. You weren't negligent. So there, the fact that it turned out that way, none of your responsibility. We have a law, Eid Echad Ne'eman Bisurin. When a person tells you something's kosher, you're allowed to believe him. And you're allowed to act on it. One person, man or woman, tells you it's kosher. Why? Because I processed it. I saw it processed. And I know that it's good. You're allowed to rely on him. So you rely on him, and it turns out it's a mistake. And you ate something trefu. You did something wrong. You're not responsible for that. You did what the law requires. Even if you could have gone and checked yourself, you don't have to go and check yourself. The law says that one witness's statement is credible. It carries legal weight.
Whoever he is.
Well, basically, if he's Jewish, and it could be a man or a woman, that should be an adult, not a child. And there are other conditions. He shouldn't have any personal interest. I mean, you can imagine. But the point is, imagine that the information is accessible. I could get it myself. And so-and-so says to me, it's kosher. And I eat it. And then it turns out to be mistaken. It was treif. I'm not responsible for that. Rambam says, you don't have to do tshuva for that. You don't have to do tshuva for that. Because you were neither deliberately transgressing nor negligently transgressing. Tshuva is for deliberate or negligent transgression. Yeah.
So there was a case in Muncie, New York, where a guy was selling treif chickens to the whole community, and he was saying it was kosher.
Yeah.
And after they found out that it was treif, they did a half day fast. So why would they do that if they weren't obligated?
Okay. I'm glad you asked that. I was going to ask the question a little differently, but it's the same question. When you come to Yom Kippur, the Siddur, the prayer book in Yom Kippur, talks about asking God for forgiveness, and it has a whole list of categories of transgressions, and one of the categories there is ba'onus, what we have done through onus. I just got finished telling you that you don't have to do tshuva for onus. So the standard explanation is this. I did everything that I have to do. I'm perfectly blameless. My record is clean. But why did God engineer that I should have done something which objectively is wrong under these conditions? If I had been a better person, I would have been protected from that. So although this isn't the transgression, it's a signal that not all is well. And that I should investigate myself to see what could possibly have let me become liable to this particular action for which I'm not responsible. So that's the same thing is true there. How did it happen that for a period of time, a person who was selling meat to the community, and so many people were taken in by it, there must be some weakness in the community that God didn't arrange that it should be discovered, as could easily have been arranged. You know, somebody came to the store at an odd time and found something going on, and it could have come out very easily. It didn't come out, there must be some weakness in the community as a whole.
So then is that guy like a messenger of God, or is he actually liable for doing it?
Okay, this is a philosophical question. I'll answer briefly, but then, of course, there's really no end. Consider a case like this. A person is tried of a capital crime and convicted. And the execution is set for 2 o'clock. And at 1:59, somebody from the street shoots him in the head. Is the guy who shoots him at 1:59... guilty of murder?
Yes.
You bet. Why? Not because he deprived him of a minute of life, but he had no right to kill him. He had no right to kill him. He's going to die. That has nothing to do with it. He had no right to kill him. So here, if God wants the community to be awakened to their weakness, that's his business. That doesn't justify the transgression this guy did, selling treif meat, and thereby everybody eating it, and then finding out later that they were fooled and realizing they were weak. That doesn't forgive it. He's not the one, through a transgression, to teach them what they need to know. So he's definitely guilty. He's definitely guilty. There's a deep point here. We don't judge the appropriateness of an action by its consequences. A bad action can have good consequences, and a good action can have bad consequences. We don't judge the appropriateness of an action by its consequences. We have rules that apply directly to the actions. Sometimes the point of the action produces consequences, that's something else. But just saying bad things came out of it doesn't mean that the action is bad. And just saying good things came out of it doesn't mean the action is good. This comes up in Kiruv. There are many groups who, for the sake of Kiruv, relax the rules. And they say, but look at all the people who jumped on board. Absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. You don't measure the correctness of the action by the supposed impact that it has. God's, the impact, the effect of the action is up to God. It's not up to us. Our job is to fulfill his will, which he has revealed to us in the rules that he gave us. The consequences are his business, not my business.
Even if all the consequences are either bad or good?
That's right. It has nothing to do with it. It's absolutely nothing to do with it. I remember hearing from Rabbi Soloveitchik many, many years ago. God is about to destroy the first temple. And he says to Jeremiah, go to your cousin and buy a field and write up a document and put it in a jar. You know, this was a symbolic debt, you know, even though there's going to be destruction and an exile, not all is not lost, and there'll be a future, and so forth and so on. So he goes and does it. When he finishes the transaction, he turns back to return to Jerusalem, and he sees the smoke coming up from Jerusalem. And he says to God, you tricked me. Because you knew, as long as I was standing in Jerusalem, you wouldn't destroy it. You wouldn't destroy it in front of my eyes. So you tricked me to get me out, and you could destroy it behind my back. That's an extraordinarily pointed idea. Right? So, that's another element here. Now, let's just speak a little bit about this, and we'll finish for today. The Rambam here makes a point. When he does tshuva, he's obligated to confess. Why is he putting the emphasis on confession here? But the truth is, he's putting the emphasis on confession because the Torah puts it on confession, and so does the Talmud. He quotes a verse. This whole section is full of verses. For every detail he has a verse. The verse says, "V'hizvadu es chatasom asher asu." They shall confess their transgression that they have done. Happens to be in the context of offering a sacrifice, and that's another interesting implication. Don't confuse sacrifices with the institutions of another religion, where you can do what you like, and if you pay it off in the end, it's okay. No. Sacrifice is just an external expression. You have to do tshuva with the sacrifice. Okay, but why is the verse prescribing confession? Why is the verse prescribing confession the source for tshuva? Indeed, if you look at the book of Deuteronomy, there are a number of verses that describe tshuva explicitly. You shall return unto God. Okay, what the commentators say over there is the verb form used in the Hebrew is ambiguous. It could either be a command or a prediction. The future verb form can be used as a command or can be used as a prediction. And they said, the Rambam, along with others, interprets it as a prediction. That's why he doesn't use that as a source. But then, like the Gemara says, Hagufa Kasha, why not interpret it as a command and use it as the source? Why go, you're interpreting it as a prediction, not using it as a source? So your only source is a verse that describes confession. Even worse than that. The three components of tshuva are changing your future behavior, regretting the past, and confession. Think about that. In terms of relative importance, what's more important, what's less important? Seems to me, changing your behavior, if the action's a crime, you've got to stop doing it. Tshuva without that is very, very substandard. Regret? What are you going to do? Pretend it was okay? I mean, you're not facing reality. You have to understand that it was wrong. Without regret, without changing the future, the tshuva has very little substance. Confession? So you say it, or you don't say it. So what? Okay, there are those who say it helps solidify your motivation because you said it out loud. You know, it's psychological reinforcement. Terrific. Wonderful. But to make confession the source of the whole mitzvah, the whole institution, isn't that the tail wagging the dog? It's the least important element now being the foundation of the whole. Now the truth is, you could get out of this with a trick. It's a logician's trick, so I'll mention it, but I'm not going to rely on it. What do you say in the confession? What you say in the confession is, I regret what I did, and I'm not going back to do it again. Good. Now, you're supposed to mean it. The confession should be sincere. So, A sincere confession already implies the other two elements of letting go and regretting. So a sincere confession, by implication, includes the other two. So in this way, you could get it in, right? You could do it that way. Correct, you could do it that way. But philosophically, it's very unsatisfying. It's very unsatisfying. Because still, confession by itself is the least important element. Why should that be made the source of the whole institution? Yeah.
So shouldn't it be that you should, like, regretting is the first step? Because once you regret, then you know it's sincere. Like, you know you're doing something wrong, so then you can confess.
Okay, and you should change, and at least resolve to change your behavior. Quite right. So why make confession the source of the whole institution?
I think what he's saying is it presupposes you've done the other two.
Correct. That's quite true. This is correct, but how can I give you an example? Is he able to be president of the United States? Yes. You know why? Because he has an American birth certificate. Okay, it's not because he has the piece of paper that he's... It's because he's a citizen. He's a natural-born citizen. It's not the piece of paper that makes him... True, if you have the piece of paper, it means you're a natural-born citizen. You're a natural-born citizen then. But no one would explain his appropriateness for the presidency on the grounds that he has a piece of paper. Even though it implies the right fact, but that's not the way you explain it. You explain it by saying he's a natural-born American citizen. Correct. So using the paper, you could get to it. But if you ask what the explanation isn't the possession of the paper. The explanation is being a natural-born American citizen. You've picked an item which implies the right explanation, but it doesn't say the right explanation. I think that it does express the essence of the institution. We just look a little closer. The word that we're using here is tshuva. Tshuva means return. Repentance isn't right. That's why I've hardly ever used it in the last 4 days. Repentance isn't right. Tshuva is right. Return. Return from where to where? We're returning from being distanced from God to being close to God. We said that already. Where did we say that? We said it yesterday. When we explained why in the 10 days tshuva is accepted immediately. Why is it accepted immediately? Because during the 10 days he comes to us before we do tshuva, and then we do tshuva and close the distance from our side and we're attached. The transgression sets up a distance. Tshuva recovers the distance and reattaches. So now, you're returning to God. The essence of tshuva is returning to God. Now let's reflect. Changing one's behavior and regretting the past have no essential religious component. A complete atheist can resolve to change his behavior and regret his past. Just saying, I've decided to change my behavior may mean what I used to do was wonderful. It was wonderful while I did it. But became illegal, or it became fattening, or my cholesterol is too high, and so on. I don't regret it at all. Or I regret it because I now see that I have raised cholesterol levels, and that's going to change my whole health picture, and I wish I hadn't done it. It has nothing to do with God. Regret and resolve to change have nothing essentially to do with God. But tshuva is essentially a religious performance. It's not just getting a grip on yourself and improving your life, like the self-help books and, you know, Barnes & Noble. It's a religious performance. In confession, you have a direct expression of the essence. I stand before God and say, I have sinned against you. I regret it. I'm going to change my behavior. So I think that's why confession is the source of the entire institution. Here's a very deep philosophical point. And it underlies the other two. Confession is what shows that the regret and the resolve to change are religious resolutions, not just motivated by self-interest in some other way. Okay. Both to you.